Thank you, Renee. I told Renee that she could be the lady and say it her way, and I'd be the hussy and tell it to you the way I normally say it. And my old sponsor, who was from Texas and was a lady, would say, honey, stick your tits out and be somebody because you are. And I invite you to do the same thing tonight, because you are. You're precious children of God, all of you, and you got a right to be on this God's green earth. And I didn't know that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why I stayed. My name is Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. That's the most important thing I'll say tonight. I'm an alcoholic. I'm Patty. And today, that has a whole new meaning. And what I want to tell you tonight, my sponsor, I'm sober. Oh, this is Texas. I forgot. Forgive me. February the 8th, 1977. thank you. I'm sober because of the grace of God and because of the actions of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and two loving sponsors, one at a time. One at a time. I had a sponsor for 2 years down in Florida where I found my sobriety in Lakeland, Florida. The old Texas gal who was tougher than nails but never talked down to me and never belittled me and always made me feel precious and loved. And then I've had a sponsor for 8.5 years. And through the love of those two sponsors and a lot of tolerance, a lot of patience, I'm becoming, one day at a time, everything that I wanted to be when I drank the drug alcohol. Gosh, we have to tell what it was like. It was pitiful. I hear this big word now today called dysfunctional families. And I thought, God, I would have settled for a dysfunctional family, you know. My mom and daddy didn't know one another. My mother was an old street whore, and she had this disease called alcoholism. And people asked me a lot of years ago to clean that up. You know, they said it's not nice to talk about your mama that way. And I tried saying that she wasn't nice a mother. And when my mother was sober and trying to get her act together, my mother was a good mother. And I tried saying, well, she wasn't a nice lady. And there were a lot of men in Washington, D.C. who thought my mother was a very nice lady. And it was kind of like two ships that go bump in the night. My father saw her. She was young and pretty. And my mother is dead now, died from the disease of alcoholism. My mother was a full-blood Chippewa Indian and beautiful, beautiful woman. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. And lived with my mother until I was 9 years old and a half-sister. And my mother had 4 children, and we each have different fathers, and not one of us look alike. 3 of the 4 of us suffer from this disease of alcoholism. The 3 that were taken away from mother and put in good homes are alcoholics. The one that was left to be raised with my mother in this horrible environment is not an alcoholic. So that blows the hell out of genetics, you know, and environment. I'm an alcoholic because I put alcohol up to my mouth and swallowed it. That's why I'm an alcoholic. It was a long time for me to try to figure out this big difference between fault and blame. I was an alcoholic. I'm a born alcoholic, whatever that means. Today they have another great big word for that called fetal alcoholic syndrome. Well, in 1939, it was just a baby had convulsions and usually died. I didn't die. But 2 weeks later, my sister told me much later that my mother dumped me in a trash barrel. And the reason my mother dropped me in a trash barrel is my mother is a full-blood Indian, and all her people were full-blood Indians. And if you look at me, I look kind of white. And I never belonged in my mother's world. And then when I was 9, I was yanked away from my mother very suddenly and put in my father's world, or a man who called himself my father. And my father was born and raised in Sicily and came to the United States in 1908, 18 years old, with 14 cents in his pocket. But he had membership in a very elite bunch of thugs. Now, I don't have to tell you any more than that. You know the story. Big family. And he was the head of a big family. And he was very wealthy and very powerful. And I didn't belong in his world either, because somehow I wasn't a pure Italian. I was one of those little half-breed Indians. So when I came to you, I had never belonged anywhere to anybody. And God, I wanted to belong somewhere. So my sponsor tells me when I get ready to go out of town and get on the airplane, he said, "Now listen here, darling. Don't you go down there to Texas and tell those people how to work their programs. Even though you know perfectly well how to work this program, and you probably could tell them how to work it perfectly well, don't do it." Oh, he just feeds my ego something wonderful. He said, "Why don't you just tell them about the pain? And if you tell it the way you're supposed to tell it, everyone will identify with you. Alcoholic, Al-Anon, Al-Atot, Al-Ateen, Al-Adoc. Everybody's going to identify with you." And that's what I want to talk about tonight, the pain that brought me here and the love that keeps me here. A couple months ago, when I announced at one of the groups that I chair on Friday nights, the Big Book Study Meeting, a fella came up to me, and his name is Rick, and he said, "When you go to Lubbock, I want you to look up a fella, and I want you to hug him, hug his neck, and tell him that this is from Rick, and I want you to thank him for helping me stay alive, and to thank him for picking me up when I was hungry, angry, lonely, tired, broke, and hopeless and helpless. And give him a big kiss and just tell him that he's always in my heart and in my prayers." And I asked someone tonight, I think it was Renee, about Harold Leach. And I heard that he passed about 2 years ago. So to all the Harolds out there, I want to thank you. I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being here when I came here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous January 1959, and I told you that my sober date is February 1977. It only took me 19 and a half years to make my first year of sobriety. I'm a slow learner and a quick forgetter. But I was too young and too pretty and too rich and too many other things to be an alcoholic. And I went to my first meeting in Chicago at the Bismarck Hotel on a Sunday night. And every loser, I love the way Clancy refers to it, every gray puke in town was at that meeting that night. And old and used and abused and gray and nasty looking. And I thought, my God, I'm so glad that there is an organization like Alcoholics Anonymous, because these poor suckers really need this, you know. And I was 20 years old, and I was pretty. And I thought, well, you know, this is lovely. But something happened that night. You planted the seed. Something in your eyes. The eyes never lie. Never. How many nights did I come to you? And I'd walk in the door there, and I'd say, hi. And they'd say, "How are you tonight, Patty?" I'd say, I'm fine. Plastic smile, big smile, fine. My eyes hurt, and you knew it. So I've been trudging this road for 10 and a half years, and it gets better. There's some detours that I've taken that I didn't have to take that created a lot of pain of my own making. Okay. I don't want to get sidetracked. I want to tell you about my first drink. I listen to a lot of tapes in the morning when I get up. I have tried a lot of meditation. I've tried so hard to do what it asked me to do in the 11th step. And I know how to pray. God, I know how to pray. You know, I'm real good at praying. But this business about meditating, my mind runs about 30 seconds, and then all of a sudden I go to the office, or what my husband and I are going to do that day, or this weekend, or this baby didn't call me, and I wonder, blah, 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 and there's my meditating. So I have found it, and beside that, I'm vain. I am a vain woman. It takes me a long time to get ready in the morning. The older you get, it just takes you a little bit longer, you know? And I'm coming up on 48 in 13 days, and the wrinkles, you know, I got to put all that cream on and that foo-foo dust, you know. So I put a tape on, and I listen to an hour's tape every morning. And that to me is meditating, because somehow I always hear what I'm supposed to hear. Some speakers will stand up here and tell you that they absolutely can't remember taking the first drink. Well, I can. I can tell you the exact time, date, place, the name of the place, what the day was like. It's that vivid because it was a magical and mystical trip that I took. It was a love affair that I launched on. It was a hot summer afternoon. I had graduated. I started school when I was 10 years old. When I came to live with my daddy, I was dying of tuberculosis, malnutrition, and rickets. And I was 6 months in a TB sanitarium, and then 6 months in the bed. So by the time I started school, I was 10 years old, and I finished school a month before my 16th birthday. Now, I have a lot of intelligence. I'm one of them real smart asses, you know? God, they usually die of alcoholism. And it was tested when I was in school, and it was way up over 200. But I have this other disease. It's called lack of common sense. And I'm just beginning to get a little of that. You know, I can deal with very complex situations. I can take very complex problems and I can solve them like that. But you give me something real simple like, Patty, if you don't want to get wet, come in out of the rain, darling. You know, things like that. That's simple. And I don't handle that too well. And I think, oh, yeah. And when I came to you people and you said to me, darling, it's that first drink that's going to get you drunk. I thought, God, that's profound. I never thought of it that way. Lord. And I went home and I was just deeply impressed by that. So I graduated and I had never had a date. Never. I was so ugly. God, I was ugly. You know, Oscar Wilde said a lot of years ago that you can't be too rich, too thin, or too sexy. Well, that's not true. You can be too thin. You can be too thin. And I was about 5'5½", same height I am now, and I weighed 89 pounds. And not only did I not have any bazooms, but my chest sunk in this way, see. And I had a chronic and terminal case of the zits, you know, and purple kinds, you know, and big old puffy purple kinds. And I had one always on the end of my nose. And my eyebrows grew together like that labor lead. What was his name? John L. Lewis? Was that, remember his name? Yeah. Well, I had them John L. Lewis eyebrows. And remember, I'm from the South. And the worst thing that you can say about a Southern woman back in those days was, she's loose. Hang it up, honey. Your reputation's ruined for the rest of your life. If it ever gets around town, you're loose. Well, only loose women pluck their eyebrows. And I used to have hair under my armpits about this long that you could plait. Well, only loose women shave their armpits, see? And I had so much black hair. See, and y'all thought I was a natural redhead. And I had this black hair on my legs that I never did have to wear black hose. I just wear a nude color hose, and you thought I had black hose on. Well, only loose women shave their legs, see? Well, it's kind of hard to be sexy and pretty when you got a chronic terminal case of the zits. Oh, and I didn't tell you about my kinky hair. I had kinky, kinky, kinky hair. And if I washed it in the morning by noon, it looked like I had rubbed Crisco in it, see? Greasy, kinky hair. Well, in those days, them girls had that straight hair with those bubbles and the beehives and the, you know, and I had kinky old hair, and I don't know, no matter how hard you combed it, you know, old kinks. Well, today women pay fine money to go get kinked up. You know, I'm fashionable now. And now today I spend a lot of money to have it straight. See, I tell you, I'm an alcoholic. I'm what the big book calls one of them real alcoholics. Crazier than hell. Alcohol doesn't have a damn thing to do with it. I'm just crazy, warped. All my thinking is warped. That's why I come to you to learn how to live right and think right. So when you're as ugly as I was, and then to compound it, my father had been married to a lot of years to a very wonderful woman. They had never had any children, but they adopted a girl, and her name was Patricia Ann, and my name was Patricia Ann. That's kind of embarrassing to have two Patricia Anns in the same house. You know, you have to explain a lot. So he just changed her name to Patsy and my name to Patty. He did it without my permission. And I thought how arrogant that son of a bitch was to change my name without my permission. Now, I had had, by the time I was 12 years old, four or five last names. My mother was Marilyn Virginia Gray Dove. And the government changed the name to Mary Virginia Gray. So my name had been Gray Dove, changed to Gray, changed to Tarantino, changed to Tarrant. And then the sucker changed it from Trisha Ann Tarrant to Patty Tarrant. Well, now that was the last straw. I didn't care what you call my last name. But by God, get my first name right. That was my only piece of identity. And this Patsy, this stepsister of mine, adopted sister, as ugly as I was, she was pretty. She was blonde, blue-eyed. She had skin like peaches and cream. She was round where a woman ought to be round, flat where a woman ought to be flat. And I hated that bitch. And she was dumb. I mean dumb. When she bought home D's, we had a big party in our house. My lowest grade in school was an A-. For all those years that I ever went to school, was an A-. My father never let me forget that. Even if you're ugly, the law of averages says you're going to get a date. You keep trying hard enough and your father's got enough money, you're going to get a date. Now, I want to tell you fellas in AA and Al-Anon a little story now. Now, we AA women stand up here, and Al-Anon women sit in these audiences, and we hear about the dogs you woke up with. Well, it's payback time, honey. And this old dog asked me for a date. And my father approved, which shocked me. And he was old enough to be my daddy, but he was socially acceptable to this thug. So I went out with him. And it was a hot summer Sunday. And we went down the beach from Washington, D.C. And there was a Y in the road. And to the right was a socially acceptable beach for decent young ladies of that time, and to the left was where all the loose women and hussies went, and men that gambled and ran with loose women. And this old sucker just turned to the left, and my first thought was, my God, my father's gonna kill me if he finds out I'm in North Beach, Maryland. And then about a second later, I was thinking, my heart was going boom 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 boom, and I was thinking, oh God, and now I get to see what them loose women and them hussies look like, and that gambling and that drinking and that hillbilly music, you know, old country and western music. And I went down there and I had my first drink of alcohol. It was wet, cold, and delicious. And you know, I have stopped talking about beer, Miller High Life beer, in such glowing terms, because sometimes newcomers just go right out and have them a beer. But I'm going to tell you that the first time I put that in my mouth, and it went over my lips and past my teeth, and it got hit my tongue, slid down my esophagus, you know, hit my belly. There was something just wonderful, indescribably wonderful. I just fell in love with it. And by the time I had my fifth beer, I thought, my God, I have arrived. Bill Wilson says that in his story. My God, I had arrived. You know, I had arrived. Alcohol did for me, it made me pretty. It made me sexy. The zits were just going away, one by one. And my bazooms were just growing, just like that. And I stuttered when I talked, and I opened my mouth, and I didn't stutter. And I had never danced before. My God, before that day was over, I was up there like Ginger Rogers, and I was looking for a Fred Astaire, honey. I just had all the right moves. I was just gliding, you know. Southern women glide. Did you ever notice that? Southern women don't walk. They kind of glide. You know? Honey, I was gliding that day. And then I got to tell you about the sixth beer. Because this is it. Here's where the magic started. And the only way that I can tell you about it and let you feel sort of the way I felt about that first beer, that sixth beer, was there's a scene from The Wizard of Oz. And it's when Dorothy is just kind of sort of new in Munchkin Land. And she's real nervous because she wants to go back home to Annie M. And here comes this bubble out of the sky. And the bubble pops and here's Billy Burke. And when I saw that movie, I was a little girl, and I thought, oh, that's the prettiest woman I've ever seen. She was just white all over. White hair, white dress, white skin. You know, Florence Ziegfeld's last wife. The only reason she was the last wife, because she outlived the son of a bitch, you know. And here, right behind old dog, here comes this bubble, see, and pop, there's Billy Burke, and I'm drinking my sixth beer, and here old Billy Burke is having the magic wand, and she's waving, and she says, darling, I give you a precious gift. You now have the ability to read minds. And she disappeared, and I looked at old dog, and he was grinning like an old cat getting ready to eat the mouse. And I read his mind. Want to know what he was thinking? He was sitting there and he was rubbing his hands, thinking, it's only going to take one more beer. And I was sitting there grinning back at him and I was thinking, you sorry bastard. If you live to be 1,000 years old, you'll never get in my drawers. And he didn't. And I never saw a dog again. That's the story of my first drink. That's what it did to me. That profound change. And for the next 22 years, that love affair that I had with alcohol, a love affair that I had never had with anything, anybody, any place, for one day at a time, I knew a lot about living one day at a time. I didn't learn that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned it out there. For one day at a time, I try to recreate that feeling again. One day at a time, I try to find in alcohol what I had found that day, that I was pretty, that I was sexy, that I didn't have to stutter, that I could talk to people, that I could be acceptable, and that people didn't have to know that I was a little half-breed bastard, and that I belonged somewhere. And I drank for 22 years, and the first 15 years, if I said to you were bad and nasty and bad things happened to me, I'd just be a big old liar. I had fun. I had fun. There's a guy out in California, he said, you know what fun is? There's a difference between fun and fun. I had fun with alcohol. See, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out that I was addicted to a lot of other things. I used to think I was just a pure alcoholic female. I used to go around bragging about that. I've never had a cigarette in my life. I don't know what marijuana is. I don't know what cocaine is. I don't know what Thorazine is. I don't know what Valium is. I don't know what well, wait a minute. I did have a token Librium pill in 1963. I went to a doctor in Pittsburgh and I said, I drink too much. You got to help me. And he says, I have something for you. Wrote me out a little piece of white paper. I took it to the pharmacy, filled it. It was green and black, big, kill a horse to swallow the damn thing. Chased it down with the beer. Slept for 3 days. Now, it's a party girl. Party girls can't party much when you're sleeping by yourself for 3 days. So I threw those things down the toilet. That's my token experience with drugs other than the drug alcohol. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous thinking I was a pure alcoholic female. And when I sat around the meetings and read the book and listened, and really listened, I found out that I'm addicted to a lot of things. And I was addicted to action. God, I loved action. I don't know if y'all were bar drinkers. Up where I come from, all the women in AA, practically all the women were home drinkers, you know. They drank at home. I used to wonder about all those females I met in bars, but I don't meet too many of them in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I would go to the bar, and I'd get out of my car, and my heart would be starting. Bum, 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 bum. And I'd put my hand on that doorknob, and it was like electricity, you know. That just electricity would shoot up my arm. God, my feet would start tapping, you know, and I'd want to move. And I'd go in, it was dark. Mysterious. Somebody was talking about the mirrors in a certain bar made you look gorgeous, you know. Yeah, and the lights. And that's what I went for. Excitement, action. And there I could be anything I wanted to be. I'm an actress. I'm an actress. I know a lot about playing roles and masks. And for 15 years, those first 15 years, I could go in the bars or in the cocktail lounges, and I could be anything you wanted me to be. But you had to tell me what you wanted me to be, because I didn't know who I was, or what I was all about. And if you wanted me to be a lady and you were paying for my booze, I could be a... Oh, I loved being a lady. Oh, I loved being a gracious lady. Oh, God, honey, sugar could just drip from my lips. Just, oh, southern bad that I was. Just, oh, sweet petunia. You know, guys, you know, how cute I are. You know? And then I like being the hussy, you know. Shooting pool and drinking suds. You know, listen to that country and western music. God, I love being a hussy. Oh, and that music playing, lay your head upon my shoulder. Help me make it through the night. God, I could just cry and drink that beer. And then I could be very prim and very proper, you know. Act like one of them Yankees, you know. Look down my nose. My people came over on the Mayflower. How'd yours get over, honey? You know? Gosh, And I lied. I just lied. And the worst part about lying is what you come to believe is truth, and it's lies. That, you know, the worst part about lying for me is that over a period of time, I couldn't differentiate between the lies and truth. And I lived in fantasy world. I think one of the neatest pictures I ever saw beside Wizard of Oz was the... What was it, the Secret World or Wonderful World of Walter Mitty with Danny Kaye? Oh, I identified with that movie, see? And I come to believe these lies that I told, and I tell you about one of my lies. I went to Pittsburgh, and I taught school. Oh, I was sitting at a bar, at the Hop and Scotch Bar on Fifth Avenue, Fifth and Forbes, in Pittsburgh. And my friend at the time, Rosemary, she was a school teacher, and oh, she was just going on and on about her profession, and I thought, hell, you know, anybody can be a school teacher. If you want to be poor and live at the poverty level, you know, be a school teacher. And I said, hell, there's nothing big deal about being a school teacher. She says, well, I bet you couldn't be. Well, you know, that's all you have to say to an alcoholic. I said, put your money where your mouth is. She said, I bet you $100 that you couldn't teach school. I said, how long? She said, 1 week. So I phonied up a master's degree. You know, we don't mess around with bachelor's degree. I phonied up a master's degree, went and interviewed, got hired, taught for 1 week, collected the debt, liked it, and stayed on for 3 years. And I taught special education. Now, here's the lie to end all lies. I was going to Duquesne University at night for my doctorate degree. I was actually going to school for my doctorate. I had never been to college a day in my life. And I was doing well. Husband number four. Don't hold me to that now. Four. was a conservative Jew. I remember I met him and I decided I wanted to be married to him, and I went home and I told Joseph. He was 8 years old. He had made his first Holy Communion. And I said, Joe, I said, I've met this fella and I like him a lot and I think I'm going to marry him. And I said, we're not Catholics anymore, we're Jews. And he said, what's that? And I told him. And when my son was 12, almost 13, he was bar mitzvahed. And today my son is 29, and sometime on the high holidays he goes to shul, and then sometimes he goes to midnight mass at Christmas time. He doesn't know what the hell he is, you know. He thinks he has the best of both worlds. I lived 7 years with that man, and not until years later did he realize that I was not a Jew. That's it. I was a liar, see? I was a liar, and I was a good liar. In order to be a good liar, you have to have a good memory. You know, it's kind of hard to be, if you don't remember the lie you told yesterday. Now, in the early part of your drinking, before all these burned out brain cells, and you still got a 200 IQ, it's all right. But you get that booze sloshing up there, and you kill all these thousands of brain cells, and after a while, you can't remember the lie. So when he starts catching on, you know, and all these inconsistencies, you just move on. And you don't get divorces. You never get a divorce, you know. In the old days, you had to establish things like residency. I was never one to stay in a place very long, you know. Had the pot, the golden rainbow, the pot at the end of the rainbow was always out there, and that's where I was going to go find it. Happiness, whatever happiness was, I was always searching for it. It was that next town, that next man, that next bar, that next drink, see. So I would never get divorces because it took time and money, two very precious things to a practicing alcoholic. You know, we have to conserve our funds. We got to drink. So I just got married on a regular basis. You know, every time I'd come in the heat, I'd get married. I had good morals. I just didn't sleep around, you know. It wasn't nice to do that. Those nuns had done a job on me, you know. It's a mortal sin to commit adultery. I wasn't committed. I was married, you know. So when I got sober, I had to get a one divorce and a bunch of annulments. I had one of those sponsors that said I had to clean up the wreckage of the past, and she meant it quite literally. By the way, out front, y'all have got those dolls, those sponsor dolls. Have you seen them? You squeeze them. That's not the kind of sponsor I had, you know, that said, easy does it. Live and let live. My sponsor said, zip the lip and cross the legs, honey. No sex, no dating, no nothing. I said, how long? She said, we generally start with a year. In your case, we may make an exception. I wasn't allowed to ride in a car with an AA member, male, if there wasn't a third member present. I lived in Florida. There are no buses, and I'd be walking down the road going to the meeting that night, and some old guy, been sober 3 days longer than God, you know. Jesus, senile at best. And he'd say, Patty, you want to ride to the meeting? And I'd look in the car, and there wasn't a female or another male present. I'd say, no, thank you. Katie said if she caught me in a car riding to or from a meeting with a man without a third person, that I was fired. And I believed her. But you see, on February the 8th, 1977, I got so tired. People who are not in our beautiful program say, what happened that day, Patty? Like you're expecting to tell them that some bad thing happened. And I said, I don't know. Just on that day, I got tired. I was just tired of fighting. I was tired of remembering the lie I told you yesterday. I was tired of cutting corners and shooting angles, taking shortcuts with life. Mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, I was tired. I just didn't want to do it anymore. And on that day, I said the prayer that every AA member has said at one time or another, dear God, help me. And he did. Didn't do it the way I wanted it, but he did it. And I figured as long as he was keeping his end of the bargain up, that I would hold up my end of the bargain. And I did what I was told to do, begrudgingly. When I came to you on February the 8th, 1977, I weighed 375 pounds as best as they can put it together. I had no hair, no teeth, no fingernails. I was covered with syphilis and wine sores, and I was dying. And that day, my heart stopped. And for about 2 or 3 weeks after that, my heart would stop on a regular basis, and they were just trying to keep me alive. I was in the hospital part of it for about 5 months. The people of Lakeland, every road, every mile of that road, they walked with me. The only way I could stay in that hospital was that if a person was with me around the clock. And every 2 hours, a member of AA would come and sit by my bed for 5 months. And then they put me in a treatment center in that hospital. And I listened. And they assigned a sponsor to me. Down in Florida, they did things like that. I don't know whether they still do. But they thought that you were, not you, I got to remember, this is an I program. That I was so sick that I didn't have, I didn't have enough intelligence or smarts or whatever it takes to put two and two together to figure out to ask. And so they assigned me a temporary sponsor. And Katie took me home and fed and clothed and supported me. You know, and I hear people say in AA meetings, carry the message, don't carry the alcoholic. And I'm ever so grateful that Katie didn't listen. Alcoholics don't generally do what they're told to do. They generally do what they want to do. And she thought I was worth the price. She was loving, but tough as nails. She never talked down to me. I remember one time Katie told me, she said, darling, don't you ever let me hear you talk down to an alcoholic. She said, we've been talked down to enough out there. We don't need it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't you ever call somebody stupid or dummy. And she said, don't you ever let me hear you badmouth the Al-Anon program. Apparently she had been she was sober for a long time. She had found her sobriety in the great state of Texas. And in those days, there weren't a lot of females, so the Al-Anon women helped her grow one day at a time. Katie was real strong about this book here. By the way, I want to thank... They gave me this book in 1972. I was serving 2 life sentences in Lowell Penitentiary. It was the 5th time I'd ever been in prison. And one was for first-degree murder, and the other was for being a habitual criminal. And I was guilty of both. And the AAs would come into Lowell Penitentiary, and they gave me this book for this was my book. They gave it to me. I didn't have to share this book with anybody. And I slept on it like a pillow. And I always want to thank institution committees for taking the time and the effort and the love to take the message into prisons and jails. I want to thank you for coming to Lowell. I want to thank you for looking good and smelling good. And for giving me coffee and donuts. The only reason I went to your damn old meetings was coffee and the donuts. And to see what you were wearing and how you were wearing your hair and what you looked like. And you never treated me like scum. You never treated me like scum. And you were walking copies of the big book. And Katie was real strong about this book. And that part of Florida that I came in, there were many kinds of AA. That's not nice to say, is it? But there were many kinds of AA. You know, we like to stand up here in front of the podium and tell you AA is the same all over. That's a crock of poop. You know, I've heard some people say I've never been to a bad AA meeting. Well, maybe that's true, but I've just been to some that are better than others. Let's put it that way. You know, and in Florida, I'm a street person. still at heart, I'm a street person, and I walk around and I smile at you, and I'm sizing you up. And I'm taking your inventory. You better bet your life I'm taking your inventory. This book invites you to take inventory. It says, if you want what we have, well, how in the hell can I figure out if I want what you have unless I take your inventory? Now, if you're telling me that I'm supposed to zip the lip and cross the legs, and you're walking out of the meeting and 13 step and every newcomer that comes in, you think I'm going to pay attention to what message you're carrying? Like hell I am. I'm going to tune you out and tune you off. See, I don't listen to you in here. You know, we're real good AA in here. We're real good AA. Around those tables, oh God, those words just slip right out of our mouths. I can quote this book backwards and forwards, but can I live it out there, see, on the job? When one of them damn Chicago Pakistani cab drivers gets in front of me, do I practice the programs or do I shoot him a bird? When Illinois Bell shuts my telephone off because the woman next door who has one digit off didn't pay her bill, you know, and I call up and say, darling, I think you made a mistake. You know, how loving am I? What am I practicing the program then, you know? So these three types of programs. The first one, I would sit back and I looked at you, and there was the kiss people. Oh, those were the huggy huggies, kiss, kiss. Hugs, not drugs, you know, kiss, kiss, kiss. Keep it simple. And they kept it so simple they didn't even have a damn program. And then there was the Jesus freaks. And now, don't get me wrong. Do not get me wrong. I think Jesus just is very powerful. Buddha was powerful. Gandhi and a lot of other neat people. But these Jesus freaks would take you down the creek and baptize your ass. Excuse me, but that's what they do in the name of AA. I'm going to make you clean and well. Well, damn, I started out in life as a primitive Southern Baptist. I don't have to tell you people from Lubbock any more than that. Hell, I got baptized and rededicated 22 times. In 1 month. I've been sprinkled, dunked, and then I became that Roman Catholic when I went to live with my father. And I have signed more pledges than I did bad checks. And I signed about 2,000-3,000 bad checks. Those pledges, and every time I signed a pledge, I meant it. I meant it. So I didn't want to have anything to do with those Jesus freaks that were baptizing people, old Clarence Snyder and his bunch, God rest his soul. You know, that didn't do it to me, and I'm not knocking religion, I'm not. I went to the Baptist church because I was forced to go. I went to Catholic church because I was forced to go. I come to AA because I want to come to AA. This is my church. This is what I believe in. This is where I found God. Never have found God one in church buildings. Never have. I looked hard, too. God is in people. In people. And then there were the big bookers. And Katie was a big booker, and they were kind of a rare bunch. They laughed a lot. They laughed a lot. And you know who they laughed at? They laughed at themselves. And that was neat. They weren't poking fun. I'm real suspicious of people that poke fun at other people in the name of humor. Oh, I was just teasing. Like hell you were teasing, you know. Gee, you got a nice head of hair, Gogi. Why don't you comb it sometime, you know? That doesn't impress me. But these big bookers, they just, one day at a time, they showed up. They showed up clean. And they put the dollar in the bucket. And when they had something to say, they said, and when they didn't have something to say, they passed. Katie told me, she said, darling, the steps were written in the past tense, and that means that if you haven't worked them, don't report on them. She said, if you report on the steps and haven't worked them, then you're given your opinion. Opinions are like assholes. We all have one, and they smell, you know? She said, you work the step, and then you share your experience, strength, and hope around the tables. And if you haven't done it, you say, I pass. My name's Patty, and I pass. That's easy. I didn't get to talk a lot, and I like to talk. Yeah, I like to talk. So I'd go to meetings, and I had to go to meeting every day, 2 on Saturday, 3 on Sunday. When I woke up in the morning, I had to roll out of bed on my knees, say the third step prayer, whether I meant it or not. And in order to get used to being honest, I had to tell God if I meant it that morning. And I would say it real quick, because see, I'm a beer drinker, and beer drinkers blow their bladders, and I usually in the morning had to go to the bathroom real quick. Well, I couldn't go to the bathroom until I said the third step prayer on my knees. And I'd say it real fast, and then I'd say, I didn't mean it. But that's okay. Katie said, just so you tell God the truth. Some mornings I started saying, I mean it. That was scary. That was scary. I was always frightened of the unknown. I didn't know what God had out there for me. And then I would call Katie up, and she'd say, what are you doing, getting ready for work? That was another thing that sponsor said, got to get a job. And one you pay taxes on, honey. One of them legal jobs. Because I know a lot about earning illegal money. I did get cute. Go to work. My first job. And I tried. God, I tried finding a job. And I had to go fill out 5 job applications every day until I could come to the AA club. I wasn't allowed to come to the club until I'd filled out 5 job applications. Hell, I tried every... I even tried being a weeky-watchy mermaid. And I almost got the job, and they found out I wore a wig because my hair was growing back. And they were afraid my wig would just float right up in the top of the water, so I didn't get the job. So my first job, my first sober job, big old brain, and I used to be a multimillionaire. First job that I had to get down on my knees and thank God for, washing dishes at the Waffle House in Lakeland, Florida for $1.15 an hour. Katie told me I had to thank God every day for that job. And I'd get down on my knees at night and say my 7-step prayer, and I'd say, well, thank you, God, for another shitty day. Then I got a second part-time job. I cut cloth 2 nights a week. Still had to go to 10 meetings a week. Got a third part-time job being a secretary from 9 till 12, 5 days a week. Got a fourth part-time job being a bookkeeper from 1 till 5. Went to 10 meetings a week. Still wasn't allowed to talk at meetings. Katie told me to zip the lip and cross the legs. One morning, it was a Sunday morning, I think it was Easter Sunday, I decided I was going to sleep in. I wasn't going to make it to the 10 o'clock breakfast meeting. And there was Katie at the 2 o'clock detox meeting in Bartow, Florida, always at the front door. Every time I didn't want to see Katie, I'd come in and there she was, right at the front door, smiling. Hello, darling. Hello. She'd say, well, you missed it. I said, what did I miss? I don't know. And I've heard Jimmy say the same thing. I think you people in Texas indoctrinated in people, you know. And she said to me, I heard what I was supposed to hear at the 10 o'clock meeting, but we'll never know what you were supposed to hear. You missed it. See? You missed it. And after that, I didn't miss the 10 o'clock meeting anymore on Sunday morning. We alcoholics can't stand to miss anything. We got to know everything that's going on, you know, everything. I didn't want to miss anything. I'd been missing out on life too long. She decided for me that I should go to college. So I went, and I went to college, and I got an associate's degree. She also decided that I had to pay back the wreckage of the past, that I couldn't declare a bankruptcy. And I owed about $250,000. And she said, we're going to pay it back one day at a time, $1 at a time. And you will pay it back. If you don't pay it back, you will drink again. It's been 10 and a half years, and it's about $4,000. One day at a time. I don't have two nickels to rub together, and damn bills are paid. I remember going into the People's National Bank in Lakeland, and I went every Friday, and every Thursday night, Katie and I would work my budget, and I'd go home and I'd say, where the hell does it say in the big book that you got to work a damn budget on Thursday night with your sponsor? Where is it? Just where is it? She says everything's in the big book. She's full of poop. And she'd say, it's in there, honey. You just haven't found it yet. And I'd go home, by God. She just wanted me to read the book. That's all. Everything she told me to do, she says, it's in the book. And I went into the bank and I'd get $51 money orders. Now, after weeks and weeks and weeks and months, this woman called me over who happened to be the branch manager, and she said, excuse me, she said, why do you come in every week and buy $51 money orders? And I said, you really want to know? She said, yeah. I said, well, sit down, I'm going to tell you. And I told her. And in those days, money orders cost 50 cents. So I was having to spend $75 to pay 50 back. And she told me that from now on I could buy 75 $1 money orders, no fees. People help you out there. That's not a nasty world out there. People are going to treat you out there the way you treat them generally. That's what I found. That's what AA taught me. See? I wrote a letter. Dear Uncle, I am alive and well. Guess what? I'm alive and well. What do I owe you? And I addressed it to the IRS. Washington, D.C. And they sent me back a letter, and it was not a form letter. It said, isn't it wonderful you're alive and well? And it took a number of months, but they helped me recreate the past. And they put all those little pieces of paper, those little W-2s together, and for the 15 or 16 or 17 years. And they didn't charge me any penalty or interest. The IRS didn't. See, they can be nice people, too. And I paid them back. When I was sober 2 years, I don't, what time is it? God, I talk a long time. When I was sober about 2 years, I had a job opportunity in Hammond, Indiana. And I went to Katie and I said, Katie, what do you think? And she said, I think it's about time you go. And I thought she'd say, no, you can't go. God, I was scared. And I thought, ah, state of Florida will never let me go. I'm on life parole. And the state of Indiana doesn't want cons, they want taxpayers. They want reputable citizens. And what normally took months and months and months for permission took 10 working days. And I'm standing there with my travel papers and my sober car and my little possessions. And I'm saying goodbye to Katie and the guys from my home group. And I was scared. And I came to Hammond, Indiana. And I got the job at the steel mill. And they let me work from 6 in the morning until 12, 1 in the afternoon. And then I went to Purdue University. And 82, I graduated. 83, I wanted to write my CPA exam after working in a sweatshop, a CPA sweatshop. At the funny thing, at the steel mill, I was making $26,000 a year as a secretary. And then now that I'm a big shiny pants graduate college person, I was making $16,000 a year as a junior accountant in a CPA sweatshop. I thought, God, this is progress. But I had to intern for a year. And then I wanted to write my CPA exam, and the state of Indiana had denied me the right to write my CPA exam because of my criminal record. But I had been pardoned by the governor in 1979. I don't have a criminal record. And that's a story in itself, how I got a pardon. Fine art of persuasion by a recovering alcoholic lawyer. Actually, it was a veiled threat, but... I went to my sponsor and I said, I should be able to write my exam. And he said, yeah, you pray about it. And I got to praying, and I told you about my meditating, how that goes. And I thought, well, wait a minute. If the ACLU can help all those black folks get their rights and all them minorities get their rights, they can help me get my rights. So I called up the ACLU, and boy, they were hot. They wanted my case. So So this, they assigned me this female lawyer, and we sued the state of Indiana, and I won the right to write my exam. And this was a little old, proper, young attorney, and she never cussed. She never cussed. She wouldn't have said poop if she'd have had a mouthful of it, you know, that type. And I remember her looking at me that day, and she said, "You bet you better pass." And I did, on the first setting. These last 10.5 years have been wonderful. There's been a lot of pain involved. Wouldn't be life if there wasn't pain. I've learned that you can't have the mountains without the valleys. I've learned that in order to be real, real life, that you have disappointments, and you have rejection, and you have a lot of times where you just have good old belly laughs. And then there are serious times when you just do the next right thing. You just do it, you know. My father, I hadn't seen him in years. He had disowned me. He had let it be known whether I lived or died. He didn't give a damn. And my sponsor, Katie, was the first one. She said, "You write him. Don't take his inventory. You just tell him that you're sorry and that you're doing something about your life one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I wrote, and he didn't respond. He didn't respond to my amends the way I wanted him to. And then I became a sponsoree of this Jesuit priest, this evil-hearted, black-hearted Jesuit. I think all Jesuits are evil. That's my personal opinion. But I stick with him because he seems to have the right answers for me. And he said, "I think that's a good idea. You write to him every 3 months. Don't take his inventory. Just tell him you're part of it, what you're doing. Make it very newsy." And I would start out, "Dear Daddy," and tell him what was going on and sign it, "Love, Patty, your daughter." And I would send him Halloween cards and Christmas cards and Father's Day cards and Sweetest Day cards, and that sucker didn't answer one of them. And 6 years went by. 6 years. And I prayed, I prayed, I prayed for God to relieve me of the obsession of him. Not to get us back together again, just relieve me of this hurt. And I got home late one night from a meeting, and in the mailbox was a letter. And I knew right away it was my father's handwriting, and I went in the house shaking and crying, and I called my sponsor right away. You know, that's what you do, 12 o'clock at night. And my sponsor says, "What does the letter say?" And I said, "I don't know. I haven't opened it." And he said, "Darling, why don't you try opening it?" And the letter said, very short and sweet, "I need to see you right away." And I called him. And he said he was dying of cancer and he wanted to see me. And there was a blizzard in Chicago and a blizzard in Virginia. And I said, "Come on, God, you know, cut me some slack. Don't do this. You know, I didn't mind all the other things, but don't do this. Let me see him." And I called my sponsor, and my sponsor is in the Navy. He's not a chaplain, by the way. He's in Naval Intelligence. I can't figure that one out. He's an electrical contractor. I can't figure that one out. He's got 5 kids. I can't figure that one out either. Well, I made it to Virginia. I had done time in the state of Virginia, and the Virginia police escorted me 90 miles to see an old mafia guy die. That's sobriety. That's what sobriety's all about. That's what this program's all about. And I saw Daddy 10 minutes before he died, and he looked at me and he smiled and he said what I've been waiting to hear all those years, 40 some years. And he said, "I love you, baby, and I'm so proud of you." And on February the 8th, 1977, my husband and my son had promised me that if I just stayed off the streets, I was on life parole from prison. If I just stayed at home, they would give me the booze. And at night they would come in, and I didn't have a bed. I just had a rubber sheet. And they would pick me up and throw me in the tub and hose me down. By that time, they don't bathe you anymore. They just hose you down. I was too fat anyway. And they would clean the vomit and the poop off of the rubber sheet. And I remember spraying the room with Lysol. And put me back there and put the booze down and shut the door one day at a time and hope the hell I would die. Now, February the 8th, that husband walked out on me. He said, "You know, Patty, I can't take you anymore." And he left. And my son was so angry that day. I remember he was trying to get me cleaned up, and I was giving him a lot of lip and a lot of mouth. And he got so mad, he put the hose right in my face, and he said, "God damn it, you bitch, why don't you do everybody a favor and just die?" And he ran out of the house crying. And that same kid, Katie, told me, she said, "You keep your mouth off of him. You let him see by your example that this is AA. You don't tell him about his drug addiction. You just do what you're supposed to do. Let him see the program. Let him see the big book. You go to work. You become a woman, a human being. You become his mother. Not his best friend, his mother. Something you've never been. But you keep your mouth off of him." And one day at a time I did that. And it took a long time. It doesn't happen overnight. I remember one year I went to Florida. I always went back and saw my son. And he, by this time, was drug-free. He used to say, "If my mama can do it, I can do it too." And he had gone to school and gotten his degree and was becoming very successful. And I remember this one year, something was different. We were walking down the shopping mall, and he knew a lot of people in the shopping mall. He had a business there, and he was holding my hand. And we would stop at the different shops, and he'd say, "This is my mom." And I'd say, "Nice to meet you," and we'd walk on him. He was holding my hand. And when he put me back on the airplane about a week later, I remember he hugged me. He's a big fella. He picked me up and hugged me, and he kissed me, and he said, "I love you, Mom, and I'm so proud of you." And that's what AA is to me. I don't have a lot of material things, but I have something that money can't buy. I like me today. I approve of me today. I really do think I'm a precious child of God. And my home group does call me Precious Patty. And I'm beginning to believe that I'm worthwhile. I used to be intimidated by certain of you people. I got invited very early in my sobriety to give leads at meetings and then conferences. And I used to go to these conferences, and I didn't talk too much when we would be invited out to dinner and things like that, and people would talk. And I would be intimidated, not by your material success, not by your beauty. But there were a lot of speakers who had a inborn graciousness about them. They had learned something from their moms and dads. They had learned manners. They had learned graciousness. And that's what intimidated me. And today I'm not intimidated by that anymore. I thought for a long time that I may want to be a lady. And I thought, hell, that's just another label. I'm just settling for human being. I like what Clancy says. No matter how spiritual you get, you're not going to get out of this world being anything other than a human being. And I just want to be a regulation human being. Pay taxes, laugh, cry. One of these days maybe have some grandchildren. And a part of being human is being a part of this world in a way that I've never known. Before I end tonight, I would like to introduce you to a man that's pretty special to me. And when I met him, I met him 5 years ago, and I didn't want to fall in love with him. I told God on a regular basis, one day at a time, that I absolutely didn't want to fall in love with this man, and it wasn't the one I wanted picked. You know, I had a certain criteria for the one I wanted to marry, and this wasn't it. By God, he did 22 and a half years flat in penitentiary, you know, in hell. I wanted at least a doctor, a lawyer, you know, somebody worthy of Precious Patty, you know. And hell, he worked with his hands, and he worked hard, and he was trying to make something of his life, and I, you know. Come on, Lord, I'm tired of driving Chevys. And God has a hell of a sense of humor. And, you know, my heart said, yeah. So I would like to introduce you to Richard Locascio. Would you stand up, Richard? This is my husband. And then before I end, I want to introduce you to somebody else. It was hard for me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to be friends with men and women. Men, I seemed to be able to be friends with. There were so many more alcoholic men than there were alcoholic women. And my first home group was a stag group, and I was so sick I didn't know it was a stag group, but it was a bunch of men, so I went there. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. And they thought, well, she's so sick. When she gets a little bit well, we'll tell her we're a stag group and she'll go away. Well, a year later, they made me GSR. And that's kind of hell going downstate to area assembly and saying, my name is Patty and I'm GSR, the Wednesday stag meeting. They think you're a queen in drag. Oh, that's the story of my life. And I got to know some AA women, and I sponsored them, and there's a lot of beautiful babies in my life today that teach me one day at a time how to be a woman. But I told you that I've learned a lot from Al-Anon, and I never had a best buddy, you know, a best girlfriend. I never had that growing up. And at 48 years old, I've got a best buddy. I got a girlfriend, and it's nice. And I want to introduce you to my Al-Anon best friend, Gogi, from Monticello, Indiana. Would you stand up, Gogi? Gogi's going through some rough times right now. And she walks with dignity, like a precious child of God. And that says a lot to me. See, I can read this book and study it all day long, and all I have to do is to watch people that I love in this program, the Mikes and the Renies and the Gogies and the Tims and Slims and Jims that are walking out there and doing it one day at a time. And that's why I keep coming back. Pain brought me here, and your love has kept me here. Thank you so much.